Okay.
Good.
Yeah, I thought
that sound has humor laughs, but that's my sentence. Especially this time of the year, it's time of Christmas, and people always get sucked into parties and drinking. But this was a story which happened in Sydney. The dangers of being drunk. This gentleman, he was at an office party, and decided, just a little drink, doesn't do any harm, one thing led to another. And he was, quite over the limit. He decided to just chance his luck and drive home. And of course, as you drive and you're drunk, the police will try and catch you and give you a big fright. He would sometimes take your car away. So he decided to take a chance. He worked out he wants. He probably obeyed all the police at that time of year. So he was driving home and his luck ran out. He drove along a road where the police had set up a roadblock, testing every car driver for alcohol. He knew there was no escape. He knew if he tried a U-turn, that was an admission of guilt. So he just resigned himself to his fate. When his turn came, he stepped out of the car, and the policeman gave him a little breathalyzer tube to blow it. And as soon as he took the tube, there was a sound of a crash, because one of the cars coming into that roadblock was travelling slightly too fast and had gone into the rear end of the car in front of him. And the policeman heard that sound too. And the policeman said, "It's more important that I address this road travelling incident than to check your alcohol level. Get back in your car, sir, and go home." He came within a couple of seconds of getting caught. He thought he was so lucky. Except the following morning. The following morning, he was woken up, he had a hangover, with someone ringing his doorbell and they would not stop. So he groggily got out of bed, put on some pajamas, went to the door, and there was two Australian police officers standing outside. He got scared for a moment, and then he thought, they can't arrest me now. I'm not driving. So he was confident when he asked, "How can I help you, officers?" "But would you mind if we look inside your garage, sir?" No, this is my car. And so he went to the garage and opened his garage door. And that's when he almost had a heart attack. Because in his garage, it wasn't his car there. There was a police car. When I was going through the study here a few years ago, it was in New York, going through the airport customs, got a customs team and security checks. And they said, "What have you got under your robe, sir? Is that a suicide belt under your robe?" I said, "No, I haven't noticed. It's only fat." And the officer said the same thing. I could do a different technique to give you a very good breadth of ways to meditate to come into the head. So, close your eyes, first of all. Developed this sort of meditation for children in Australia. And when I taught it with adults present, they said, "Wow, that's really good. Can we do that as well?" So people who have difficulty following things like the breath or following feelings in the body or want to know just how we can develop something like mindfulness, it's always good to innovate. So, with your eyes closed, just schedule or as comfortable as it possibly can. We know that it's better. And once the body is relaxed and peaceful, and it feels safe, secure in this bed, imagine you tell the kids what they're doing. I don't have to be so perfect, exactly. Because I'm not sure, I'm sure of this. Each one of us, we were always told we're not good enough. How many of you are not good enough? But no one actually explains to me, what is good enough? You're always supposed to be aspiring to something. But aspiring to what? If you are an athlete, there's always another world record to beat. I'm always trying to improve upon your personal best. But I figured out, always trying to improve on your personal best makes you more and more stressful. So I always try to not improve on my personal best, but improve for my personal worst. See if I can get a worse joke than I said before. See if I can lower the standards. Okay, I can't resist this now. The worst joke, the corniest joke that I've ever told, about the two carrots walking down Baker Street. They're already laughing and they haven't even told the joke yet. There were two carrots walking down Baker Street and one of the carrots got hit by a drunk driver throughout Christmas time, and the other driver took out his cell phone, called up 999 emergency service. Come quickly, need an ambulance. Carrot down. And so the carrot, the ambulance came in a few seconds. And the ambulance medics, they rushed out and they took one look at the injured carrot and they realized this was serious. This was life and death. So they put the carrot on the stretcher in the back of the ambulance and invited his friend to actually accompany them to give support. And the ambulance, dee 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 dee, ran down. I could work on my special effects. Dee 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 dee. Ran down Baker Street, into the nearest hospital, into the emergency department. The triage nurse took one look at the injured carrot. Life and death situation, straight into emergency surgery.
And all these people putting IVs into the car, ECGs and EEGs and all this other stuff, and shooting stuff into his body to try and keep it alive. And they ushered their friend into the waiting room. And I'm not sure many of you have ever been in a waiting room of the ICU, the emergency department. It's one of the most tense places you can ever be. People are waiting there, their loved ones, their friends, and on the edge of life and death. And it's so, so scary, even for a cat. And after 2 hours of raw anxiety, a surgeon came into the room, looked around, and said, "You, Mr. Carrick, you must be the friend of the Carrick inside the surgery." "How do you know that?" He said, "I got some good news and bad news for you." And the friend Carol wandered away. "What is it? Tell me what's happening. I'm so afraid." He said, Your friend, Mr. Carrot, he's going to survive." Said his friend, "I was so worried. I thought he was a goner." He said, "No, he's going to survive, but the bad news is because of his injuries, I can't control it. So because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life." I don't know how many times I've told her, but I can't say with a straight face. It's a stupid, it's a very stupid joke. That's why I like it. You don't have to be so perfect. You know, sometimes when you learn this one, it's many of you actually see that book which I wrote, first book, Open the Door of Your Heart. You don't know maybe why where that book came from. And it was because, you know, I was gathering all these stories over many years, and that one lady came up to me over in Australia, and she said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you. I was going through a terrible divorce." And those of you who have been through divorces just know that it tortures you. If you have an injury from a car crash, people can see it. But they don't know the injuries, the traumas, the wounds, the slashing and the cutting and the bruising, which occurs when people who choose each other for one reason or another, they part, they divorce. Dreams and hopes of most of your life get just crumbled. So, you go through this terrible divorce, and she said, "Those stories which I told, even stupid jokes, and kept her alive." She'd been through this many times. She thought of suicide, but it worked. She said, "It's a crime which I've done. If you don't share this more widely by writing it down in the book." And I said, "I'm too busy. I've got so many other things to do." I wasn't actually too busy. It's more like too lazy. But then she said, "What's this?" Must have picked up on the eye that I was twisted. Anyway, we're all activists and make the get through suicide. She told me, "Why don't you write them in a book?" I said, "I can't, too busy." So she said, "Well, I have your permission." And she was a really smart woman. She totally sidestepped my refusal and used psychology, which has really called me out. So after writing a couple of stories, she said them to me. They were awful. They were terrible. I can't put my name to that. So there's only one alternative. Do it myself. So that's how she got me to write the stories. So I just wrote them down. And once I wrote them down, I never published any book before. I didn't know what to do with them. So what had happened was, I just had someone put them on the old CD, the old discs. I was going to Melbourne to give some talks, and I said, "Can I get them before we go? Because I may not
find somebody, I'll inquire when I get to Melbourne to see if there's any publisher who's willing to look at this. You know what happened? The first talk I gave in the University of Melbourne, after the talk, this woman came up and said, "That's a wonderful talk. I work in the publishing industry. If ever you have anything you want to publish, please let me know." And I stabbed with her right there and then. But in the front of that book, you will find a little poem. "Guard yourself a moment in peace. Guard yourself." You have to give it. Don't expect to get it from other people. "Guard yourself a moment of peace, and you'll realize how needlessly you've scurried around. Be kind, and you will notice how your judgment of others was far too severe. And learn to be silent, and you realize you talk too much." And I got that a long time ago, and it really meant a lot to me. And this evening's talk, I'm focusing on learn to be kind, and you'll understand how your judgment of others and yourself is far too severe. You don't have to be perfect to be enlightened, to be happy, to be successful. Think of the kindness. And many, many times in my life, I always thought I had to really strive to live up to the expectations of others, to please others, to be a good monk, to be a good son, to be a good, I don't know what you do in your life, to again, to beat your personal best. It's crazy, isn't it? And every now and again, something comes up and you realize you have judged yourself way too harshly. I went once to visit one of the great monks in Thailand. His name was Ajahn Tet, and he lived in a monastery on the banks of the Mekong River. Is it still loud enough? Okay. On the banks of the Mekong River, up in the North Sea. Not many people knew him, but I knew him because when I first went to Thailand 44 years ago to become a monk, he was in hospital with cancer, incurable, looked after by the best doctors in that land, and when they said that there's nothing he could do, he decided it's much better to die in his monastery with his monks in the banks of the Mekong River rather than just die in a hospital. So he went there to die in back of his monastery. It was about 25 years before he died. He did die, but it took a long time. He was a special monk. And when I went to see him, I was interested in meeting him, but also I had a lot of questions to ask and a lot of fear as well, because some of these monks could read your mind. And my mind was not ready to read. Not in public. Would you like your mind to be read? And all the secrets told to your partner? Don't worry, that's an invasion of privacy. And now we're still in the European Union, we have data protection laws. And I'm going to disagree if I tell what you've been thinking. And anyway, if you do read somebody's mind, you read one person's mind and it's trash. It's like reading an ill-written novel, pulp fiction,
You read one, you don't want to read it again. It's not worth reading. But anyway, this one was very powerful. I was scared what he would read. But nevertheless, I was intrigued with all the list of questions I had to ask him. But as soon as I went into the room to have a personal interview, all my questions disappeared. I wasn't at all afraid. In fact, I never felt so safe. It's okay. Go further back.
I never felt so no, nothing at all.
Checking, okay. Anyway, I never felt so safe, so accepted, so loved in my whole life. There was no fear at all, because this gentleman, this monk, you knew would not harm you at all, would not judge you, would not criticize you, would accept you totally as you are. With all my faults. With one of those wonderful times when you receive experience. So, I'm trying to learn this talk is no one is perfect. Not even this microphone. It's okay, microphone. I'll allow you to do this. It's okay. You see that? You allow it to be and stop criticizing it and widen your area of love to even microphones and the problem disappears. This is a tangent, it's a true story. One of my disciples spent a year in the monastery in which I teach over in Australia. He went back to Frankfurt to continue his education. He told me the first day at Frankfurt University, he passed the ATM. And the ATM, he described it, made a gurgling sound. And he swore that the following actually happened. When it made a gurgling sound, he thought the ATM was welcoming him onto that campus of that university. And so whenever he went past it, he'd always give him what we call kindness and goodwill. Dear ATM, may your money never run out. May people never swear at you when they find their bank balance is zero. May the thieves never try and attack you. May you always live happily and healthily on the campus of this university. And he always said hello to his ATM machine. For months, until one lunchtime, he was sitting, and I interrogated him, saying, are you sure this happened? Yeah, it did, but really sure? Said, yes, because I'm going to tell people about this. Please tell them. I would not lie to you, or even try to see you in any way, actually, because he was a good friend as well as a disciple. So he said he was sitting, having his lunch, not within sight of the ATM. And no one had been close to the ATM except him for about 15 minutes when he heard the gurgling sound again. The same welcoming which he heard on his first day at the university. And he turned around and saw a 20 euro note come out from the machine. No one had put any credit card close. No one had typed any password into the machine. It was sat idle there for 15 minutes. But just to make sure, he went to his friendly ATM, picked out the note, weighed it, does this belong to anyone? No one replied, so he put it in his pocket and walked away, thanking his friendly ATM. Ever you run out of money? Don't swear that stupid ATM. Don't curse it. Be kind to it. Stroke it. Dear Adrian. Will you? I'm a bit short of cash this week. May you be happy and well. And cough up 20 euros. Yes, you were. The weird stuff, you know, happens in life. It was one of my groups I was with, they were doing a youth group. At the end of the youth group, they were going down to the beach. But the boot of the car was jammed. And they couldn't open it up. And that meant they couldn't go to meet their friends by the beach. And they were trying. Well, for a long time, about 15, 20 minutes, when I happened to walk past, they said, "Adjo, Brown, you've got all the powers. Can you open the boot for me?" They gave me the key. Said, "I'll open it if you promise to become a bhikkhu." That was a mission. "If you promise to become a bhikkhu." He said, "Yeah, okay." Turn the key, open the boot. I should have done that. But anyway, what happened next, there was a lawyer sitting next to her. And she said, "Well, okay, I promised to become a bhikkhuni, but I never said in which life." She got off the loophole. But even machines, sometimes it's amazing, just with some kindness, how you can get them to do weird things and work. Anyway, going back to like the kindness, this monk I saw was just so kind. It was like, you know, a grandmother, but you know, without any sort of sharp edges on her. He just loved you unconditionally. He was just happy to be with you. He was not going to criticize, harm, shun. I have no questions. When you feel with all of your imperfections, with all of your faults which were still there, totally accepted, it became so peaceful, so at ease. How many people have you been with where you feel totally accepted, where you don't have to change at all? You don't have to improve. You don't have to get better. They're very rare, but they teach you why you are good enough. This is the third talk in a row where I've taught the simile of a forest. Maybe in London there's not enough forests. And the only forests you find are just manicured, have arborists making sure they're not sick, having people make sure there's no diseases in them. I'm talking about a real forest, a natural forest, where there are no gardeners. And in those forests, you never find a tree which is straight. They're all bent and twisted. You never see a tree with all of the branches in the right place. There are branches all over the place, in the wrong place, twisted. Some branches have been torn off or damaged, or just bent in half because of the storms and other impact. And the trunks of the trees is all damaged and scarred with knobs and cankers and other wounds of their journey so far in their life. I've never seen a perfect tree in the sense of one which has never been damaged. And in fact, if I did see a straight tree with all the branches in place and all the leaves green and none of them munched by insects, it would be beautiful. It would be like plastic. It would be imitation, not real. And in fact, all the trees where I find joy and happiness the attractive trees, they are the ones which are all twisted and bent and damaged. They are the beautiful trees, the damaged ones. Somehow or other in our life, people say, you're damaged goods, therefore you're stigmatized and you're not accepted anymore. To a lesser or greater degree, we are all damaged goods. Look at me, the bad jokes I say. That's a sure sign of being a damaged monk. But if you are damaged good, if you've got history, if you've been wounded and hurt, sometimes you can see it, sometimes it's underneath, but it's there, and you know it's there. The trauma of your life so far, the times when you haven't been treated or mistreated or misunderstood, you struggle, but it's so hard and you fail, so you think you're no good. You try again and again you're beaten down for unfair reasons because you may be a woman or you're different or you're just LGBTQIA or because you're a bhikkhuni or you're a nun or you're something from another race or tradition or religion or whatever. There's so many reasons why people are stigmatized and pulled down and pushed down and trampled on and traumatized. That doesn't mean you're stigmatized. You belong. You belong to this incredible, wonderful, beautiful, varied forest called humanity. If you don't believe me, just go through a real forest. Have a look for yourself. And those who have been the most damaged, they're my favorites. They're the beautiful ones. The twisted and bent ones. So if you have a partner who's twisted and bent and crooked and scuffed, keep them, they're the best. And for goodness sake, don't try and straighten them up. Which is where, again, we get caring from. What is actually to care? Have you really been cared for? That monk cared for me 100%. That's why I didn't have any questions. I just wanted to find some super glue and glue me to the ground so they couldn't make me leave. Well, they actually, somebody explained it with the simile of the spikes. Many beings have got spikes coming out of their body. Invisible spikes. You can't see them. Some of them are very long, very sharp, invisible spikes. You get scratched walking past them in the street. You get too close to them and you feel very uncomfortable. Those are the very angry, nasty people in this world. So spiky. If you want to be kind, you get cut when you try and help somebody. Most people have average spikes. The people you maybe work with, associate with, you don't get cut or scratched, but you get too close into their personal space. You get scratched. Some of you form trusting relationships with somebody. You're close friends, partners even. But you get too close and you get scratched. People have got these spikes, long ones, medium size or short ones. But I hope one day you will meet people with no spikes. And get as close as you like, right inside of them. You never felt that you're pushed out, that you're scratched, you're hurt, you're harmed. You are totally accepted. Those are the rare ones. People with no spikes, they will never harm or criticize you. You can say the most stupid things, make the most terrible mistakes, and they will just laugh. Not because they're putting you down, because they know that life is so absolutely ridiculously funny. When I first became a monk, I was in Thailand. I had to learn the local language. It was not Bangkok time, it was Laotian time. And there's a poor monastery. So whenever I needed anything, I would go to Ajahn Chah. He had a big water jar. When you got anything, it was in the jar. You did anything, toothpaste, you put it under the jar. Oh, something here, here you go. If there wasn't anything, you didn't have it. So one day I wanted some soap to wash with. The word for soap in Thai is sabun. I made a simple mistake. Sapo, instead of sabu. Sapo, I said. Now, sabu is a Thai word for soap. Sapo is a Thai word for pineapple. So my teacher at that time heard I wanted some pineapple. And he asked me, what do you want pineapple for? And I said, to wash. And he almost got on his chair laughing. And he told all the other people, that some people from Macron said, oh, you know, in England they wash pineapple. And someone laughs. It's good for their skin. Maybe that's why it's so white. He never let me forget that. But not with matters. I certainly learned the difference between a pineapple and a bar of soap. But, because I realized after a while, that's one of the reasons why this Thai teacher couldn't speak any English. He had so much fun with his Western disciples. We caused so much merriment for him. Oh, this is funny. But it was okay to make a mistake. We made our teacher happy. And we learned at the same time. Making mistakes, not being perfect, was not a problem. It was one of the reasons why I sort of learned to develop what today I call the 70% rule. I learned this when I was a school teacher. I was actually a school teacher in Devon for 1 year, high school, and teaching maths. And of course, when I had to set an exam, it was only for, I think it was the year before the O levels. So I mean, it wasn't that important, but I'd never set an end of the term exam before. I always like end of the year. And so I asked the head of the department, give me some advice, how do you set an exam? And they said, don't make it too hard. Because if it's too hard, the average score of 30 kids in your class is saying 3 out of 10, 4 out of 10, then it will lose motivation. They'll come away with the idea, even though it's a wrong idea, they can't do arithmetic. Because I said, too hard exam. But if it's too easy, they all get 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10, then what's the point of it? Everyone gets a 10 out of 10. It was too easy. So they said, try and set the average score to be 70%. Because 7 out of 10, 70%, is a pretty good score. You know, it means, yeah, you can do maths. And the 30% where they make mistakes, that is the most important. Because that's where I, as their teacher, can discover where they never understood things. And in the next lessons, I can focus on those points where I thought they understood, but obviously I failed to teach properly. That's where I learned the importance of mistakes. So, if you've got a partner who's 100%, problem, you never learn anything that way. If they're 5%, drop them also. But if they're 70%, they're the best. There you learn about love, acceptance. That's where you grow. There's no growth if you're already 100%. Same with life. If life went perfectly for you, who never had any challenges, any mistakes. It would be a wonderful life. But what would be the purpose? You wouldn't learn or grow anything. So that's why when life is not 100% for you, when things don't go just so smoothly, just trying to find a place for a Bickerton monastery in England, it's tough, it's hard, but if it was easy, you would not learn anything. But if it's too hard, you give up. So the 70% rule, never expect life to be 100%. Never expect life and yourself to be perfect. Otherwise, you would not grow. And I like that simile because life grows, developing, naturally. If you try to make it develop, you stunt it. It's a weird thing. But that doctor who came to see me, who wanted to resign. And I'd known him ever since he was, you know, just 4 or 5 years of age. And brilliant man, worked so hard to get to the point of becoming a doctor in a hospital. How much sacrifice and hard work that was. When he came to me one lunchtime, he said, "Something happened this morning, I can't do this job anymore. I need to find another job. I'm resigning." I asked why he was resigning. And the problem was that that very morning, one of his patients had unexpectedly died. Never thought that would happen. I never saw the signs. It turned out it wasn't his fault. Even the most senior doctor would have seen this, but he felt responsible. And the worst part of it was that as his patient's doctor, a 23-year-old young woman, he was the one who had to tell her husband. And they loved each other so much. They'd been married for a couple of years, and they were looking forward to a long, long life together. And he had to tell him. Surprisingly, he had no wife left. She died. And to add the soul, not the soul, like the chicken, to the wound, that his 2 young children and no mother. And it hurt him just so much, more than anything else he'd ever experienced in life. When he saw the devastating pain of the unexpected death of a young love, and just wondering just how the hell he's going to look after these 2 children. This is life again, falling apart. Where's mummy? Can we see mummy now? She's gone. What do you mean she's gone? Kids not understanding. And him having to deal with his own grief and terror of his future. And this young man had to say that to him. And he said, "I can't face the possibility of doing that ever again. It hurts too much for me, let alone that poor family. I feel so guilty." And that was where sort of I told him he'd misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. Your job, your priority is never to cure people. If you ever think that your first priority is to cure, you will have this happen many, many times. You can't always cure people. It's an impossibility. But there's something you can always do. That's to care for people. Care. You never need to feel a failure if you make caring the priority. Doesn't matter who comes into your guardianship for that time as you know, your patient. You can always care for them. And that changes the whole
the whole process of being in ICU in a near-death situation, sick, disease, knowing you're cared for. And I don't know how many of you have been through hospitals, through long illnesses, maybe trying to overcome cancer or other diseases. How many of you feel you've been really cared for? Or just find this amount to cure you? Especially end of life situations, where sometimes doctors with good intentions make curing far more important than caring, to the point that the end of life is just so intrusive. And sometimes you think so unnecessary, because curing is paramount and caring is relegated to, well, maybe we've got time. Now, the reason I introduce that story is for you. Have you ever tried to cure yourself of your bad habits, of your weaknesses, of your faults? You judge yourself, I've got to cure this one, I've got to cure that one. I've got to cure addictions. And how many people I've seen addicted to this drug, that drug, addicted to pornography, addicted to violence. Has it ever been cured? What's the solution? So many people have told me they're not good enough, they don't deserve to be free from their addictions. That's the problem. Call out of it. Be careful. Don't just care for them, but teach them, encourage them, show them the way to care for themselves. I belong. I'm a tree in the forest too. And actually people really, they actually do love me for who I am. I don't need to cure myself. I care for myself. With that doctor, he told me, I knew this, that by caring for his patients, he cures so many more. And instead of hating the disease and trying to get rid of it, he cares for it, relaxed it, that people feel free. We're talking about this. Now, I don't mind mentioning it to you. We saw a couple of his old friends, you know, as he was out. This man, he was above with me some time ago, and he got so sick, he had two types of typhus at the same time. And he was just so sick, I was there at the time. Oh, he was that close, he sent him down to Bangkok, and the used all our contacts to have an ambulance waiting for him. This is a real story. Waiting for him at the platform of the main train station in Phuong Hong in Bangkok. And the doctor, I knew him, he said, as soon as I saw him, he won't survive to hospital. He was that close to death. But they pulled him through, but he was sick. Always sick. And you have a monastery down in Kitters, there have been down there. And when I went to visit many years ago, he was in the attic. You know, I don't know if you've ever read these old romance novels, like, was it Jane Eyre or something, where the crazy people, the mad people, were kept in the attic. And that's like, as I remember, this Mike was out in the attic, and he couldn't go out because he was so weak and no energy, had like Crohn's disease or something. And every time he just got to the door, he just had no energy left to go further, just crawl back to bed. He was bedridden like that for a couple of years. What was the solution? The best medicine, homeopathic, allopathic,
any empathic. That wasn't psychopathic. I didn't make trying to fix him up until the end of that time, good old Andrew Sorrento. He just had his insight. Trying to do things differently. He went up to the room. Remember, King Sarah telling me this. Went up to his room, his attic, had been out in the attic for 2 years, trying for this to no energy. And said, I've come up here on behalf of all the monks and nuns of this monastery, all the people who come here to feed us, to support us, all of your relations back in Tennessee. He was a Rhodes Scholar from Oxford before. And I always remember, hi y'all. I can't do that. He tried to teach me a long time. How are you all? Such a lively, but he's a champion wrestler as well. But anyway, there he was, all skin and bone. And this abbot, Andrew Sumato, he said, I come up here on behalf of everybody who knows you and loves you and cares for you to give you permission to die. You don't have to be alive. It's okay to die. We're not going to try and cure you anymore. We're going to care for you. Let you be. See what happens. And apparently he just burst out weeping, cried his eyes out. And from that day on, he got better. Now how many years ago was that? 25 years ago? But he's still alive. He came so close to dying because he thought he had to get better. To die would be letting down all his friends. All the people that are the worst thing he could do for them, to die. So when he had permission to die, he started getting better. That's what I mean. If you try and cure somebody, sometimes you're making them sick. If you care for them, really care for them, non-judgmental care, it's okay if you die. It's alright. It happens. You don't have to get better. You don't have to be 10 out of 10. He was a Rhodes Scholar, remember? Successful person for much of his life. He didn't know about failing. Trying to please others was killing him. I don't know if any of you have read the book by Anita Anurjani, Dying to Live. I remember seeing videos of interviews with her. She wasn't a Buddhist, she was, I think, a Hindu or Catholic or something, I forget which. But she was sick all her life, but very successful. Great husband, lovely family. On the outside, just a really successful woman. She was in Hong Kong, that's why I found out. An Indian working in Hong Kong, because I got lots of followers in Hong Kong. And anyway, that she was having another operation when she died. Died on the operating table. That is near-death experience. And she told exactly what happened. It was real, it wasn't imagination. And even the doctors say, how the hell did she hear me say that? I was in another room when I said that. But anyway, that it was true. But the nice part about it, that she went over to this, you know, this nimitta, to this light, you know, which is what we talk about in Buddhist meditation, and other types of meditation as well. And anyway, that she felt so loved, so at peace with herself. No judgment. No sort of trying to be something she isn't. Accepted as a crooked, damaged, not perfect tree. And then, you know, she interpreted that as a union, a God experience. You don't need to call it God and then to great barriers between religions. Just call it perfect love, acceptance, and peace with who you are. Without anybody trying to judge you or criticize you or change you, not trying to cure you of all your faults. And at that point she realized that she had beaten her cancer. She said, cancer, go now. Because she realized the whole reason behind it was trying to please others. And the tension, the stress throughout her whole life had never been good enough. Maybe she got that from her teachers. Top of the class, yes, but you get distinctions. Getting top A levels, but you get A level plus. Degrees, but you can always get honours with distinctions. And you can get, I said the other day, you get a master's, MA. I've got one mate who's got two MAs. We call him Mama. PhD, you can get another PhD. Where's the end of this? And that was her life. Everyone else was saying, wow, you're just so successful. But for her, there's always something wrong. And that literally was killing her. Trying to not be who she was. And accepting that she would never be perfect. But trying. Perfectionists are some of the worst. They haven't felt and tasted failure. They don't know how to deal with it. And they strive until it literally kills them. What the heck are you doing that for? Who says they're not perfect? That's why one of my gripes, my passions, is the self-improvement industry. Who says you're not good enough? If you get the lucky one, you have to improve. I thought of that a long time. I've been around now just over 44 years. And every year, you grow in compassion and kindness. That's what we do. That's our job. You know, some people just, you know, just learn how to sing. Some people learn how to make bread. I learn how to make tummies. Because every year, your heart gets bigger in kindness. A long time ago, my heart was so big, it was pushing against my ribcage. But I carried on to being kinder and kinder and kinder. Until my heart grew so big, it pushed down and out. So 44 years of creating a bigger heart, a wider heart, a more embracing heart. That's why it caused this. It's just a big heart with nowhere else to go except up here. That's true. Have you ever seen thin mugs? They're always pretty mean sometimes. Never trust a really thin spiritual leader. They haven't ever developed their kindness enough. It's true, right? Anyway, so why are you trying to live up to other people's expectations? Controlled by trying to please others. Trying to live up to what they say you should be. Trying to fit in. I love it when you don't fit in. Sometimes it's very hard to fit into a tube train of my size. Takes too much space. But not. It's great being different. You don't need to be sort of to fit into everybody else's idea of what you should be. That is stress. Stress, and that kills you. So instead, says, when you're not subject to other people's judgments, you don't judge yourself. Don't you judge others. That means you can just relax and be calm. And that also means if anyone wants to meditate, become enlightened. What is enlightenment anyway? What is an enlightened person supposed to look like? You can't tell. An enlightened person is someone who's beyond wanting, beyond anger in the world. But nothing to be angry about. Like my teacher, I made a mistake. He'd get angry at me because it was so funny. But I make a mistake myself, I think it's really funny. I laugh at my own jokes, at my own stupidity. And make fun, be that kind of person, be that people know about it. What was the, some of the alpha, not just the my God, I'm sorry, probably, who cares, I don't know. Sorry? All the stupid things, one stupid things I did, you know, that have to wear glasses, and reading glasses. Nothing for anything else, but you know when you first time you wear glasses? You know, you wear glasses because you know you look a bit blind. So I was going into town one day, and oh my goodness, I haven't brought my glasses along. Turn around, please, we're going to go back, get my glasses. My driver, I respect you as a teacher, as your father. You know, sometimes you're very stupid. Have a look on the end of your nose. You ever done that? God, there are people gone about it. So anyway, I don't know how many thousands of people I've told about that stupid thing about not knowing where my glasses were because of the end of my nose. So, we all do things like that. But how many times do people actually admit it? And be an ease with it? And be happy to be making mistakes. Which means you're not judged. When you're not judged, you don't need to strive. You can enjoy. Have any of you got grandchildren? And they don't judge you. Hello, mummy. Hello, granny. They just love you. That's why you love to be with them. When they get older, they don't love you the same way anymore. Isn't that a shame? So anyway, it's great to learn from even a dog or a cat, especially from dogs. They love you no matter who you are. They sit on your lap, sometimes you come home late, sometimes you kick them or something, and then they'll bite you back. Dogs, remember reading this one story about in New York this happened. There was a couple of NYPD officers went to interview a suspect for this crime they thought he had done. Because he was violent, they brought a big police dog with them. Just in case, you know, he got sort of a little bit aggressive with them. So this person, who the policemen were interviewing him, they asked many questions, and the dog was just sitting next to the suspect, and the suspect started stroking the dog. And of course, the police dogs, they don't ever stroke. So he's stroking them, patting them, and the little doggy was really enjoying this, being stroked. And after about an hour of interrogation, the police officers thought, yes, they have got enough evidence to arrest him. So they took out the handcuffs and they went to arrest the suspect. And because the suspect had been stroking the dog for over an hour, the police dog attacked and bit two policemen. Cool, I should have really taken the call. And I thought, oh, fair enough. But anyway, this is that kindness and acceptance, which is one of the reasons why we love folks and patients. Come and do that for us, each other. Come and do that for ourselves. We don't have to be perfect to be loved by God. But we haven't been perfect to be loved by ourselves, which is a great tragedy. It shouldn't be that way. So if you can love yourself, care for yourself, don't judge yourself, realize you don't have to be perfect to be happy, then you have a great step towards understanding what your life means. Thank you. That is comes in a sense of being, has to disappear. So you get so still that nothing moves. There's no one left to do the moving. So imagine, what all of us are acting in a big trouble now. But imagine trying to pin a medal on the air. There's nowhere to hook it. That's like trying to hook a label, enlightened or half enlightened. There's nowhere to put that label. That's why a person who says, are you right or not, doesn't really understand what the question is. We disappear. We vanish. Gone. They also, people would ask the same question to the Buddha. They would say that a person who says they're not better than anybody else, they're not worse than anybody else, they're not as same as everybody else. We call those the three conceits, the three judgments, the three measures. Are you better than anybody else? Are you worse? Are you the same? None of them apply. No conceits, no judgments, no feeling better, feeling worse, feeling the same. Well, that's getting close. Not even the next level. I told you, it would defeat the purpose. So, the book I would recommend for you is Garfield, Book of Comics. Because I saw this comment by Garfield about he would say meditation didn't work for him. So he tried meditation instead. No meditation? Tucked up in bed fast asleep. He said afterwards he feels so relaxed afterwards and so happy, but also hungry. You know, Garfield. Sometimes we read books. Why do we read books? For more information? We have an information overload. So the point is that, you know, sometimes this monk says something, this expert says something else, this expert says something else. There's so many experts. So sometimes I recommend a book. So light move. There's not enough happiness and joy in this world. So read a comic.